congratulate everybody.
I promised you that I would focus today on something which is related to the kashrut laws, kosher food, and the reasons why we eat kosher, better why the Torah, the Bible, requires us to eat kosher. This time focusing specifically on the question why we are not allowed to mix milk and meat together. Yesterday we spoke about the reasons why only certain animals are kosher, why certain fowl is kosher, why certain fishes are kosher. But there's one very big area which is left alone, and it definitely needs a lot of interpretation, and that's the issue of milk and meat. Now, to tell you again, just to remind you of this, remember one thing. The whole approach of Jewish tradition to life altogether is that it wants man to learn the art of living. And if there's any religion in the world who is absolutely convinced that it is an art to live, then no doubt it is the Jewish religion. One just does not live life. One has to learn how to live it, how to build it. And if we then ask the question, how to do that, then we get as an answer that the best approach, the most successful approach, happens to be the approach which the Torah states, by keeping the 613 commandments, to be inspired by them, because that's the way to grow spiritually, that's the way how to achieve higher goals, higher religious and moral attitudes. And the kashrut laws basically belong to that category as well. The kashrut laws are basically telling us, so we saw yesterday, and we are not sure how to take this, if this really means scientifically, or symbolically, or psychologically, but it really doesn't make too much of a difference. In all these cases, we seem to say something like, whatever enters into your mouth has a certain mental, let's say, after effect on the way how man behaves and how he thinks. It's not like some other religions have said, it's only important to know what got out of your mouth. No, we believe that it is even important to know what gets into our mouth, because what we eat influences our thoughts, our actions in many, many ways. Yeah, on a very, let's say, general basis, we can clearly see this day by day. A person who takes alcohol to himself or eats other particular things may indeed be very, very affected by what he does. He may lose his capacity to use his mind. He may manipulate his mind, and we can easily manipulate anybody's mind, and badly enough, it is still being used many times over throughout the world. And that is often done through the kind of food, the kind of consumption we happen to give to people. So if the Torah then here comes to tell us, remember, whatever you eat has an effect on your mind and on your soul, then that is not so difficult to understand. The only question is how far does that go? What are the exact circumstances? But we created yesterday a general theory which says at least that Jewish tradition tells us to keep away from these kinds of animals which definitely stand for some kind of life man should not have a part in. A more cruel form of life. We are not allowed to eat any animals which can kill. We are not allowed to eat animals which are extremely active in the physical sense of the word. So it's true about birds. We don't eat birds of prey. We always choose, whenever we eat meat, that kind of animal or that kind of bird which is basically quite passive. Why? Because we don't want to add more animal instincts to those we already happen to possess. And since the art of living is the art of balance, to know exactly how far to give in to the body and how far to allow the soul still to be the master at home, Therefore, to create that balance, to keep to that balance, one has to be careful about what one eats. So that was the general idea which we tried to develop yesterday, and we saw that many of the famous Jewish philosophers seem basically to go along with that. They happen to be of the opinion that kashrut is another way by which we no doubt can establish a higher spiritual life, which, and I just remind you of this again, does not mean that if you eat kosher you automatically are becoming a better person. After all, there are many cases where people are eating kosher and they are definitely not belonging to the best people in the world. But the whole point is that you open yourself up to the possibility to become a better person. Eating kosher creates a matzav, a spirit within man that is more acceptable to religious and spiritual ideas. The question now is, how does that work in the case of milk and meat? Now, we have to make a little journey over here, because I have to explain you some general ideas within the Jewish tradition which basically are related to the sacrifices. You know, we have a whole institution called the sacrifices. True, we haven't got it anymore today, but there is this strange thing, I would really say a strange kind of paradox in Jewish law, which says that we really are regretting in a great extent that we have no opportunity any longer to bring all these sacrifices. In the days where there was the first and the second temple, the Jews used to bring sacrifices every day, on Yom Tov, on the festival, special days, even on the Shabbat they used to bring, on Yom Kippur. It was considered something of extreme great importance. And when the two temples were destroyed, the Jews, since that day, are basically mourning the fact that they have no opportunity anymore of bringing these sacrifices. I don't know if you are aware of the fact, but if you look in the Siddur, in the prayer book, you will see that every morning, every afternoon, and every evening, we are basically asking God, please return us this opportunity of bringing these sacrifices, because we happen to miss it so much, and there is so much to say in favor of it, and we are pleading with God for something, and let's be very honest about it, for which we have very little feeling. And basically, we feel a little hypocritical about saying even these words, because if you ask me, and I suppose that's true about you as well, if I'm really waiting for the day that I am allowed to bring sacrifices again, then I must really tell you that I'm not too much waiting for this sort of thing. But Jewish tradition seems to tell us that there is basically something wrong with me, because I really should have been longing for this. Strange also for another reason, and I'm later on going to discuss that issue, because somewhere the Jewish tradition is telling us, and specifically the Kabbalistic tradition, the mystical tradition, is telling us that we also hope one day somewhere to outlive this need to bring sacrifices. As we discussed already yesterday a little, when I said that basically somehow the Jewish tradition is telling us that to live a life as a vegetarian, a person who does not eat any meat at all, is probably indeed the ideology behind all this. Ultimately we should give up on eating meat, and that obviously then also would imply that ultimately we would give up bringing sacrifices. And what are we told? One of the things which even Maimonides mentions is that in the days when the Mashiach will come and the Messianic age will start, one of the great things will happen is we will have again the opportunity of bringing all these sacrifices. So somewhere there's a paradox over here which no doubt has a solution, but I shall not go into this now, that somewhere one side we are wanting and we are wishing and we are looking forward to the moment that we can bring the sacrifices again, but somewhere later in the Messianic age, you know what I say, later in the Messianic age, even that is surpassed and man totally goes back to nature and he will even forget about bringing sacrifices, or perhaps better, he won't be allowed anymore to bring sacrifices. But I shall not yet explain this fully, because first I want to focus on one specific issue. Why we bring sacrifices is a long and very complicated story. What is the idea behind it? But one or two things can be said in general about this. What we can say is the following. The Kabbalistic tradition happens to tell us that indeed bringing sacrifices is one of the most deepest devotional deeds man can ever do. that if you know how to bring a sacrifice, and this seems to be a tremendous art, if we really look into the Jewish tradition, if you really know how to do that, then indeed you somehow touch on heaven, you somehow pick up a certain world which we are at this no moment not aware of, and we actually feel no connection with, and that is developed by the following theory. If I would have a blackboard here, it would have made it me a little easier to explain this properly, but I will try to create some kind of a picture in your mind from where we will try to develop one or two things, and by which afterwards we will also be capable somehow answering the question, I think, why we are not allowed to eat milk and meat together. I just want to remind you of one thing, by the way. Eating milk and meat together is not the only issue here. As you perhaps know, it is not only that we are not allowed to eat milk and meat together. The truth is that we are not allowed to mix it in any form, even when we are not going to eat it. The very boiling it together, cooking a piece of meat with milk together, is ultimately forbidden. And in case when we did, we have a law which normally never applies in the kashrut laws, and that is that we are told to destroy it. You make milk and meat together, you put it together, you boil it together, you cook it together. There's only one thing what you can do with it. You can't give it to your non-Jewish neighbor next door. You are not allowed to give it to another creature. The only thing what you can do with it, destroy it. Put fire into it and let the whole soaking thing go up into smoke. You're not allowed to sell it. Nothing at all. No benefit is at all permitted of all this. Which is not true about most of the other kashrut laws. Because if you have something non-kosher at home by accident, you can definitely give it away to your non-Jewish neighbor or to another creature. But you can't eat it yourself. But there is no such thing that you can't have any benefit of it in an indirect form. And here suddenly it has to be burned altogether and completely. So therefore, we have to here look very carefully into this matter, and for that we need first a general understanding of how the Kabbalistic tradition looks to these issues of sacrifices. Now, the Jewish tradition, first of all, says this. The word sacrifice in Hebrew is the word korban. It is written in Hebrew, kuf, resh, beit, nun. Korban. Which, if you correctly translate it, you will never get to the word sacrifice. Because the word korban is made from the word karof, kuf, resh, beit, which means to bring close, to bring something close or being close. I am karof to you, I'm close to you. And therefore, the idea of bringing sacrifices has something to do with the idea of bringing man closer to God. The very act of taking an animal and somewhere doing certain things with that animal, one of them is the slaughtering of it, and afterward let it go up into smoke on the altar, in the Mizbeach, in the temple. That somewhere is an act by which man creates a very close, karov connection with God. If you and I would do a thing like that today, it wouldn't have any effect altogether. We would just be burning meat, and it won't have any create any feeling within us. But it seems that a long time ago, and again in the days of the Mashiach, there is such a concept that it will be extremely effective. Now the Kabbalistic tradition tells us like this. They say first of all the following. They say you should know the whole world goes through what we can call an evolution process. A process of evolution. How? That anything which was originally created basically has a desire to go back to its root, to go back to its source. If you imagine in your mind a circle, and imagine that the top of the circle has a little opening, and that opening is the moment of creation. It is the moment that God split the material world away from the spiritual world. That's the moment that some material stuff came into existence. Now, from that moment onwards, the creation starts to develop, say the Kabbalists. And they describe that in the form of a circle, because the circle makes an important point. A circle is always moving in the direction where it started.
I first move away, but since it goes slowly around, I'm slowly moving back to where in the first place started. And that's in the Kabbalist, is exactly what happens in this world. God splitted the material world away from himself, who is totally spiritual. But since the material world finds its root within God, therefore it is constantly, I think the best word to use in English is longing to go back to God. It wants to go back where it was once brought into existence. So the circle starts to symbolize this. The world goes through a circle, we move away from God, things become more and more material, more materialistically, but slowly we move backwards and slowly and even more so, we stumble back into God. And when that thing happens, in other words, when all that is material slowly is recreated in a more spiritual form, till it totally identifies with the spiritual world, that is what the world is all about. But what is the great thing here? The great thing is that it is man's responsibility in a great way to bring this about. It does not just go automatic. The whole idea is that man is here the master. Man is told, bring it back to the source. Now, first of all, we should really ask the question, if in any way it has to go back to the source, why then starting the whole process in the first place? Leave the whole thing spiritual. Don't let it go through the material. If the only idea of having materialism, in that sense of the word, is basically to make it spiritual again, why then start the whole evolution process? Keep everything spiritual, and how more you keep it spiritual, the better than it is, then you don't have to go through all these obstacles and difficulties. So that's to this thing, to this question, the Kabbalist gives quite a brilliant answer. They said, deep true, if God wants a spiritual world, he could have left it like that. And he would never have made this material world, it only has to fall back and stumble back in the spiritual world. But there's one thing that would be missed out in that case. And another time I'm going to speak much more about that. And that thing is indeed that what I just called before, the concept, the idea of longing. What is longing? Longing is if two people or two objects or whatever it else may be are not together, but they want to come together. A certain very specific feeling is brought about, partly an emotional feeling is brought about, which is considered by the Kabbalist to be one of the greatest things God ever granted man. The great thing about man's life, and why it is that we have motivation, why we move, why we are constantly on our road and on the way to do all sorts of things, is basically because there is fundamentally, there is this concept of longing to us. For example, in the most obvious form is obviously the longing between a male and a female. This longing, which is a form of love in other words, is actually only coming to an end when those two partners are fully together. But the longing which goes there beforehand, which is the experience before, is of such tremendous benefit to man, and for that reason to the world. It gives a certain happiness which could not, say, the Kabbalist be succeeded or achieved in any other form, and therefore God decided that he wanted to give the greatest gifts of all gifts to this world, and that is to do something which creates longing. And therefore he created this circle. The circle made it possible that the art of longing would come into existence. He moves something away, and it moves more and more away, and at the same time there is this need wanting to go back, and the experience, the mental and the psychological experience of that is a most fantastic experience, and therefore God wanted and created this strange way of letting the world go through this circle. And therefore man has basically taken on himself, on his shoulders, the need to make this possible. He must move the world in a direction that everything slowly moves back and stumble back into God. By the way, this is, in according to the Kabbalah, one of the reasons why we eat. The concept of consumption is obviously a very big question. I mean, why did God not create a world where we don't have to eat? Well, we have to eat. Even Adam and Eve had to eat. Even before they ate from the tree of knowledge, they still had to eat. What is there in eating? To say just, well, we have to eat because otherwise we die, is obviously not an answer. Not from a philosophical perspective, for the obvious reason that we could straight away have said, if that's all what there is to it, then God could definitely have created a human being who does not need to eat and he wouldn't die from not eating. So there must be more to it. There must be some value in eating. So the answer is that the value of eating basically is that we take the world around us, and by at least part of it, consuming it, we by that spiritualize it. If our lives are spiritual, if that is what we are living for, and we now can pick as many things on the way with us, making part of us, like they do in the case of consumption, then we somehow start to sanctify all this, because it now becomes part of a sanctification process by which we stumble back into God. I eat not only because I have to eat from the perspective of my body, but it is also that I'm eating because the plant and the vegetable world, or perhaps even to a certain extent the animal world, are in need of being brought back to God, and one way of doing that is by consumption. In other words, the need is not on the side of the human being, but the need is on the side of that what is eaten. It requires to go through this process. And again, man, this is freedom of will, is the very one who has to bring this about. But now say the Kabbalists, and now you have to hear well, they say there is a very big problem here. The problem is, how does man keep things in that circle? How does he keep it in the circle? Because that's not guaranteed that it stays in the circle. It may break through the circle. It may do certain things in certain directions when it just moves altogether away. It's not an evolutionary process by which slowly things stumble back into gold again. But just imagine if I would have a blackboard over here and I would have that created indeed this circle, and there's a top of the circle where the split is made between the material and the spiritual. Imagine that I have something which is not prepared to follow the road of the circle, but let's say it runs wild and it breaks through the circle and goes in this direction and just moves on and on and on, totally away, by which at a certain point it can't even be picked up anymore to be put back into the circle because it is too far away. For that, say the Kabbalists, the Torah is very concerned, is very worried that it does not happen. In other words, things through this circle must keep the connection with God. Till a certain extent, it must always have a spiritual connection. And it is man who has to achieve that. By doing all sorts of acts, by thinking out all sorts of things, and he obviously, as you quite well understand, by following the pattern of the Torah, the 613 commandments, we actually learn how to keep it within the circle. Even that what has a very great opportunity that it may want to break out of the circle and go its own way, even there we must find a way by which we somehow keep it in the circle, because otherwise everything is lost and everything starts indeed to run wild. Now, to that the Kabbalists add the following point. They say, obviously, that what is the most material of all, the most physical of all, is that what has the greatest opportunity that it will break through. That what is very, let's say, materialistically inclined, what very much stands for all that what is physical, is that very thing which has, after all, the greatest chance to break through and run wild and never be part anymore of this evolution. And what is that world? Answer the Kabbalist, that's basically the animal world, and specifically that part of the animal world which happen to be these very species which we bring as korbanot, as sacrifices in the temple. They see, and there's a long theory behind it which is too complicated here to discuss now, but they basically say that all those kind of animals which are fit for sacrifices are the subtotal, let's say, or better, they are the most sophisticated form of materialism. There already, let's say, the physical world is very well represented. Obviously, if you argue that human beings are the same, after all, we are also a species which is basically made of body. But there, say the Kabbalists, there's a difference, and we have heard this yesterday already. Human beings are basically dualistic. There's a spiritual side to them and there's a physical side to them. We don't stand by its very definition for the most physical of all things, because we carry into us something which is called the soul, which is definitely belonging to a very different world. But we also heard yesterday that animals have no soul in the human sense of the word. They may have an animal instinct, which we call in Hebrew nefesh. But in any way, they belong totally within the boundaries of the physical world, and some animals a little bit more than others. And what is now the great art of bringing sacrifices, he will, is to take that kind of animal which stands as the most material and the most physical form of all physical entities in this world, the most sophisticated one, and to try to see if even that one we can somewhere sanctify and somewhere reform in a way that after all it becomes, even in that case, totally spiritual. In other words, you take an extreme physical case and you turn it around, you transform it to something which is completely spiritual. That is what you must try to do in life. And that has something to do, say the rabbis, with the korbanot, with the bringing of the sacrifices. How? The following will happen. If I know, say the Kabbalists, to take an animal and I make it part of heaven, and here you start to understand the symbolic behind it, the idea that by letting it go up into smoke, we try to symbolize the idea that we want to make it part of heaven, the whole thing goes up into smoke on top of the altar of the Mizbeah. If we manage to do that, and obviously here the managing is not that we just put fire into the place and that the whole thing goes up into smoke, but if we manage to understand what we are doing, that is, we realize that we take the most of all material forms and we completely spiritualize it by bringing it back to heaven, and that is an extremely difficult job to do. Why? Because it all depends on the human mind, if he really understands what he is doing, and therefore, by the way, Jewish law says that the only kind of mitzvah, which if you don't do it with the right intentions, it is not a mitzvah at all, that is indeed in the case of bringing a sacrifice. Any other thing which you and I may do, we don't do it with the right intentions, but if the deed is still a good deed, we still are somewhere rewarded for that. But if I take an animal and I just put it on top of an altar, let the whole thing go up into smoke, and my mind is somewhere else, and I really do not realize what I'm trying to symbolize over here, that I've just wasted the life of an animal that's got absolutely no effect whatsoever. We normally say we do not need kavana for a mitzvah. That means to say we don't need intention, in the sense that if you don't have intention, the mitzvah is spoiled. But in the case of the korban, the sacrifices, that happens to be the exception to the rule. Yes, sir?
One is, I heard, and maybe it's not true, then, that if the guy hasn't got the right kavana when he plays the sacrifice, like usually the animal just walk right up there and be sacrificed, they haven't got the right kavana, the animal fights and tries to pull back. And they send the guy back and says, wait till you get the right kavana, and they come back again, and they can tell by the way the animal reacts to the sacrifice.
I'm not aware of that, but maybe true.
And the second thing is I thought that run off the circle and go far, far away. Doesn't need free will. And like, I don't understand how an animal can run off the circle. Like, I need to understand how a human can run off the circle and go so far away that he's...
No, it has nothing to do with the free will of the animal. It has to do with the symbol which lies behind it. If, and I will tell you in a moment, you will understand a little better, if something may happen to the animal, which gives the animal the opportunity, not because of free will, animals have no free will,
right,
but because of the fact that it symbolizes something which therefore, within the human perspective, will definitely mean something like breaking through the circle, then it would become a problem. But that I need to explain a little bit more carefully. I first want you to understand the principle behind it. Keep things in the circle. That's the basic point which the Kabbalists are making. If you don't keep them in the circle, everything goes wrong, thing goes out of hand, can't go back to God anymore, the whole thing is spoiled because that's the reason why it was made, and now you suddenly have done something where it can't do anymore what it is made for.
So, rams, oxen, and
cows,
doves,
sheep,
right. Those are the things that
these are these particular animals about which the Kabbalists state that they symbolically represent the most material form of what can be seen in this world.
They're the densest, not like a lion or a wolf or a bear or something.
No, they don't see that like that, basically, because there's another thing here which probably plays a role. It must at the same time be these kind of animals with which the human being has some kind of form of a kesher, some kind of a connection, that it is in its attitude or in its characteristics, not, as we discussed yesterday, removed too far away from the human world. But in that, I will explain that as well in a moment.
About the monkey?
Pardon?
About the monkey?
About what?
The monkey.
A monkey, no doubt, has got all sorts of different things as far as beings are concerned, but it's not a kosher animal. It is not an animal which we are allowed to eat, which is to say that there are certain developments in its characteristics, again, which definitely would run totally in contrary to what the human world stands for, the world of man stands for. Therefore, it happens got to be kosher. All korbanot, all sacrifices, had to be kosher animals and such. But let's first develop this a little better. Remember again, the idea is don't get it out of the circle. So if we are managing somewhere to get that animal and to keep it within the circle and to let it totally go up into fire in the spiritual sense of the word, that means we make it totally part of heaven, then we have done something very great, say the Kabbalists, because it basically means to say that we have to brought that what was extremely to the right, so extremely physical, has now become total part of the spiritual. And what we don't want, therefore, is the following. Let me use here one or two general English terms just to make things a little easier. I think what the Kabbalists would be saying is this. You know, what we have to be very careful about is that we don't get something what we can call in English something like a super animal. We should not allow an animal to develop more than it already is. In other words, that it becomes even more part of the physical world. Because if it does that, it may very well be that after a time, it will indeed have such an incredible power, symbolically speaking, that it will definitely break through the circle and go its own way, because it will lose all the connection. It can just be kept within the circle because there's still something of a connection. Something spiritual is still there. But if you create some kind of a super animal out of it, which basically means to say that its physical strengths, in every sense of the word, become even more overpowering, and therefore it stands totally on its own, then it may well indeed break through the circle, run wild, and destroy the whole evolutionary process we are discussing over here. And therefore says the Torah as well, and I want you to hear very carefully, that one must be very careful not to put that animal into a position where it could become a super animal.
Even like genetic engineering now with cows.
Yes, but we can't obviously take it as scientific as perhaps it is understood by you. It is the symbolic idea here which is important. It is the idea is don't do something to the animal world by which the animal world falls out of the circle by making it into a super animal. Now I tell you what that means, and now you start to see the relationship with the issue of Lord and meat. If we are not allowed, basically, to create a super animal because it will fall through or will break through the circle, then what we must do is, and let me now retranslate it a little bit more within the laws the ways of the philosophy of kashrut, we are not allowed, I hope you understand what I'm saying, to make that meat of that animal more meaty. That means to say, don't push that meat too much, that it becomes an incredible physical power. Because by then it loses the connection, it's the spiritual, and therefore will break out of that circle. Now, how do you do that? And again, remember what I'm saying here. We are speaking here in symbolic terms. After all, the whole idea is a symbolic idea which has a certain ideology to itself. Now, what do I do in case that I will suddenly start to take meat and, for example, mix it with milk? What am I on a symbolic level doing? On a symbolic level. I would say this, what we are doing on a symbolic level is to try to make that meat even more meaty. Or if you want to use what I've said before, to try to make that meat into super meat. Of giving it and letting it go on its own. Because what is the great thing about milk? What is the most important function of milk? After all, the most important function of milk is basically the development of the physical side of man. There it makes an enormous contribution. In the animal world and in the human world, what we need to grow is milk. Mother's milk, or the milk of another animal, or another human being, but basically it is milk which makes that body to grow. So therefore milk symbolizes the material and physical development of man and of the animal world. Now after
that has already happened up till a point. How far has it happened? It has happened up till the point that indeed the animal has grown up, let's say. And again, we must take that in more in a symbolic form. It means to say the meat became fully meat in that respect. Now comes the Torah and says, that's enough. We don't want you to go on with this. We don't want you now to create a situation by which you are basically saying, artificially, but you are basically saying, I want that meat to develop even to higher meaty and physical situations, because by doing that you break through the circle. It loses altogether a connection with that what is fertile. So from a Kabbalistic perspective, and remember we are not speaking about science or about physics or anything like that at all, but speaking from a symbolic mystical perspective, if I take a piece of meat and I put millet over it and I would build it somewhere, boil it together, then what I'm symbolizing over here is that I use that kind of nutrition, that kind of food, which normally develops meat, like in the human body and like in the animal body. I'm in other words something saying like, I want it to grow beyond what it is now. I want to make super meat out of it. That is what I'm symbolically saying. And by that I create a situation by which that meat will stand so much on its own, and it will be so overpowering that at that moment the Torah says, if you start to do that, you can be sure about one thing. It will definitely break through the circle. And it will definitely go wild, and by that you have lost the whole meaning behind what this world is all about. Now again, that we don't get mixed up. Nobody is here claiming, neither a Kabbalist, that if you take a piece of meat and you put milk over it, it starts to grow in the pan, or anything like that. Obviously nothing happens of this kind. But the whole point is that you're taking two different worlds, which are put together, where one is already developed to its outmost, and the other one is actually saying, let's develop it even more, and therefore keep it separated. And if my theory is right, then we can obviously also understand why the Torah does not only allow us not to eat from it. Torah says not only is a matter that we're not allowed to eat it together, but as I told you before, we are not even allowed to put it together. We can't boil it together. And in case what we did, then there is one thing what we are told to do. We have to burn it, to totally destroy it. Because we have created something there which runs totally in contradiction to what the whole Kabbalistic, and therefore from that point of view, the whole Jewish attitude to life is all about. The great thing in life is to take and keep things in the circle, in this Kabbalistic circle, to keep on having a connection with that what is spiritual. If you do some kind of an act by which you disconnect the situation, you create really a disaster. So therefore keep the milk and the meat all together away. That's the reason why we are extremely particular about it, that we have totally two different kitchens, one kitchen over here, one kitchen over there. We don't even wash it together, we don't even make it to touch together. We have everything, different forks and knives and spoons, everything is totally separated. Because in this idea lies the concept of understanding, or most misunderstanding, what God wants with this particular world. So you see there's a certain connection with that particular idea, what we call the korbanot, the sacrifices. Because what we do with sacrifices is that we actually bring that meat, that what is the most sophisticated of all physical things, back to God by letting it go up into smoke. But today, since we really don't know anymore how to do a thing like that, we don't understand, and we don't grasp the full symbol behind it. And in fact, it hasn't got any effect on you or on me when we would do anything like that. It would just be an external act by taking an animal, letting it go up into smoke. You wouldn't be affected by it, and I would not be affected by it. Therefore, a long time ago, we were basically told with the destruction of the temple that we were no longer allowed to bring these sacrifices, not because it can't be done from a physical perspective, but basically because we are not fit anymore to do it. We don't anymore understand what it stands for, but we are being kept all the time, being reminded all the time of the fact that there is such a thing as the world, there is such a thing as making sure that the world happens to constantly be in connection with the spiritual, and we should definitely not do some kind of an act by which we spoil that possibility. And therefore, one must keep that milk and meat away from each other. So now we see that also, it therefore, when I eat or drink, eat milk and meat together, nobody's going to be affected by it. And I don't think the Kabbalists are saying that the definitely starts to do something against our characteristics, as we heard yesterday when he spoke about the non-kosher animals and non-kosher fishes and the non-kosher fowl. Here it is basically a symbol. Remember one thing, this is very important to be aware of. If there's anything which has made an incredible impression in a Jewish home, and which all the time reminds us of the very idea that we are Jewish, then no doubt that is this rule of milk and meat. It has made an enormous contribution to the specific and the unique form of a Jewish household. The child from its earliest moment is actually educated in an idea that there is a world of meat and there's a world of milk, and one doesn't somewhere bring these two together. The child may not understand straight away why it is, but by the time he grows up and he starts to understand a little bit more about the symbol behind it, he's already totally familiar with this whole idea in its basic form, and therefore it definitely contributed to a specific kind of identification with the Jewish people, which was a tremendous force and tremendous importance throughout Jewish history. But if we speak in general terms, we must add a few more words. Obviously the Kashrut laws in general want to tell us something else as well. And that is that man does not just eat. I would nearly say the Kashrut laws are teaching us that there's an art, another art of life, and that the art of consumption, the art of eating. Even to eat something is an art. And that doesn't mean just in the physical sense of the word how you eat it, but above all what kind of mentality have one got towards food, and what kind and in what form is one showing some kind of dignity while one is eating. Now, if a Jew, before a Jew is capable of putting something on his plate to eat it, he has to go through all sort of different restrictions and all sort of different rulings, which already tell him all the time, every symbol in itself tells him something spiritual. So that by the time that he actually starts to eat it, it has already been connected so much with the spiritual world that he can never fall so easily victim to the idea that he starts to eat, like for example an animal eats, without knowing at all what it is, except that he wants just to digest it or just wants to stop his hunger. We don't eat like that from a Jewish perspective. Indeed, there is a thing that even the very act of consumption is at the same time an act by which one can sanctify oneself. And by the way, this goes hand in hand with another thing, as you all know, we make blessings before and after we eat. We just don't fall on top of that particular food. The first thing what we ask is, what are we going to eat? And then once we know what kind of food it is that we are eating, then afterwards we find and try to find out what is the correct bracha, the correct blessing to say at the time. Now, it obviously stops man, this dedication and this being overwhelmed by food by just falling on top of it, which is so much part of most people in the world. Now every time again a Jew sits on the table, he can't just take his fork and just put it into his mouth. The first thing is what he's told to say, stop. First look what you're eating. First realize that it comes from God. Realize that it has to tell you something symbolically. Tell it to something spiritually. That life is not just existing out of the material world. And then he says, if you know exactly what it is, then look into the Siddur, look into the prayer book, and find out what kind of bracha you should make on that. So by that time that the Jew has gone through all these stages from the kitchen into his front room, before he sits down on his dining table, he is already spiritualized and already has got an attitude towards that food, which is definitely very different than in case he would fall just on top of that. Remember what a bracha is. Many people do not realize it. Somebody would ask me, what is a blessing, what is a bracha? I would answer, a blessing is a statement of amazement or of wonder. Then what I'm saying basically is that I bless God or I thank God for having created this object or this particular food. But what I think it really means is this. A human being must learn that if he takes a piece of fruit in his hand or bread or anything else as sweet, he should really say to God something like this. As you see, no, God, it's great. Fantastic. Really, when I think about it, I'm quite taken back by all this. Yeah, we take, you just put an apple into your mouth, and I just put an apple in our mouth. We sometimes make a bracha, we don't really know what we are saying, because we do it more or less automatically. But if the real religious person takes it into his hand, he's basically saying, you know, this is a very big miracle. The very fact that I can eat, the very fact that there is an apple,
The very fact is that I can digest it. The very fact that it looks so beautiful, that it happens to have all the ingredients I need to keep my body alive and keep my body in a healthy condition. All that is part of what the Braga is saying. It's like, you know, taking the apple into your hand and saying, phew, there's an apple. Yeah? Something of that kind. So the sage said, instead that you say it in your own words, by which you often may lose, let's say, the implication of it, or you may forget altogether about it, we formulate for you a specific bracha, which is basically a shout of amazement. I'm taken by amazement, I'm taken by wonder, I'm taken by a miracle. There is such a thing as eating. There is such a thing as food. There is such a thing as fruit. Every time again, we do that. We do that before a bracha, before we eat, we do that afterwards. And by the way, as you know, we don't only do that with food. We do that with so many other things. If we smell something very beautiful, or they're very pleasant, we make a bracha over it. When we see something very nice, we make a bracha over it. Basically, by the way, there's even bracha, which we say over a very beautiful person. If the Talmud tells us that the sages in the olden days, when they would see a very beautiful human being, they would also make a bracha, saying, well, you know, what great that you make such a beautiful body. But today, they say to say, we don't say this anymore because we have secondary feelings or secondary thoughts about these sort of things, and we can't say this with the right intentions. But so often, and perhaps so unconsciously, that we do it automatically without realizing that we say that we are basically losing out on the whole meaning of the bracha, but it's always better still to say it, because one day you may pick up and say to yourself, I better do this a little bit more carefully than not doing it at all. But after all, it is a form of amazement. In fact, I would go a little step further and say that altogether prayer, tefillah, is basically an act or statement of amazement or wonder. Every bracha, every piece of prayer which we say in the prayer book is basically saying to God, unbelievable, what a great thing this is. And since man has another problem, and that is that he gets easily used to anything, especially when it repeats itself all the time, over and over again, the altogether forget about the fact that it's really very impressive, and therefore the Jewish tradition came on the other side with all its force and tried to work against this mentality of getting used to things. At the moment you get used to it, the whole religion falls apart. Now, I think that if I would be correct, I think when I would say that religion is basically the art of telling you how to live with amazement. But religion is basically busy constantly to make people to be amazed. Because it knows at the moment that people take things for granted, then everything is gone, he's not impressed anymore with anything at all, and then, by the way, he doesn't even enjoy it anymore. Because then it will be a matter of so obvious and so automatic that he doesn't even say the great things anymore about life. It may be right in front of him, he may use of it, and he doesn't see it anymore because there's no reminder at all how great this thing is. The only way many men will know about this is when it is taken away for a long time for him. And then it comes back to him, he may have that amazement feeling once more back. But instead of letting it get as far as that, the sages and the whole of the Jewish tradition went out of its way to find another formula by which this particular thing basically could not happen. So you see that therefore the kashrut laws are again basically and also part of a larger system which is keeping on telling people about their connection with the spiritual, with the connection with wonder, with amazement, with miracles, so that man knows quite well where he stands and walks through this world, indeed through this circle, to make sure that everything what needs to happen within that circle actually happens. Let me make a little side comment over here, which perhaps adds a little to all this. Also, I will have to still to come back to this. Speaking about the sacrifices, the rabbis tell us that, or better, the Torah tells us this, if you carefully look, that whenever we bring a sacrifice, it should be, so it is called in Hebrew, I'm sure you've seen it, it should be a reyach nichoach l'Hashem. Which in English is always the translation, it should be a very pleasant flavor or a very pleasant smell for God. It should be a very pleasant smell for God. That's the way how it should be brought. Now what does this mean? Now are we offering God some perfume over here or something like that, saying to God, you know, you may not be in such a good mood, I have to send up some nice perfume for you, and then you may change your mind about one or two things which otherwise may, God forbid, happen today. Well, obviously, I don't have to tell you that that doesn't fit within the Jewish tradition. We're not bribing God or anything. Obviously, God can't be bribed.
So what does this mean that we are having a reach michoach l'Hashem?
Another thing, by the way, everybody will tell you that when you're burning meat, the way as they did in the temple, you can be absolutely sure that it didn't smell too great. Burning it very often with the bones, or at least the bones being burnt a little bit at the same time as well, was definitely not the most pleasant odor you could think of. So why it is that it's called Reach Nichoach L'Hashem, therefore must have somewhere again a symbolic and a more spiritual meaning. I once saw a very beautiful answer to that, given by Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, one of the great Kabbalistic thinkers, who said as follows. I thought it was quite unique. He said like this. He said it means indeed something symbolically, but something extremely forceful. He said, compared to the following case. Imagine you and I put it obviously in my own terms over here, but it's basically what he is saying. You and I are standing in the front room, and your mother is boiling soup in the kitchen. Boiling soup in the kitchen. And you smell the soup. The air brings it into the front room. So you know one thing. You know that somewhere, somebody is boiling soup. Is making soup. And the second thing you also know is that you will, at a certain moment of the day, participate in that eating of the soup. Our thoughts, your home. And you're eating tonight at home, and your mother is no doubt preparing the evening meal. But at the moment when you smell it, you don't have it yet. It is only an indication that something great is going to come. You have a smell of it, you get the first indication of it. The thing itself is not there. Not something which is automatically there. And the smell is only what goes in front of the reality of that what still will come. Like he says, for example, people used to say in the olden days that they can smell the battlefields, which can obviously have many symbolic meanings, but basically the thing is, they were not there yet, but they were getting into the direction. Now says Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi like this. He says, this is also here what the Torah means when it speaks about the Reach Nichoach L'Hashem. A smell, a pleasant smell going up to God. Bringing a korban, a sacrifice to God, is no guarantee that you get just like that nearer to God. Nowhere will you ever find that Jewish tradition would say something like, you seem to be quite far removed from God. You know, the only thing what you do, pick up a few cows, slaughter them, put them on top of the Mizbeach, let put the whole thing fire into it, and then things will work out much better. Well, perhaps you will find something like that in Christianity, but Judaism will never go for the idea that in a symbolic form, or by just bringing something, you just make it just like that. So why are we bringing the korban lot? The korban in itself, the sacrifice in itself, doesn't do the job. But what it does do is one thing. If a person wants to bring a sacrifice, and he does it with the right intentions, as we have been speaking about before, then he's basically saying to God, God, you know what? I know it is very hard, but I would like to have a connection with you. I would like to hitkarev, I would like to get a little closer to you. That's the meaning of the word korban, getting a little closer. Says God, okay, make a move. And man makes a move. He makes a symbolic move by, for example, taking this animal and burning it, by which he says, I want the whole world to be part of a spiritual connection. I want this whole world to go up into the spiritual flame of God's life. Says the Torah, okay, you know what you have done? You have accomplished something very important, but one thing you have to realize, you only have started to come closer to God. It does not definitely not do the job just like in itself and say, well, now you are there because you brought the korban. What does it mean that you are smelling the soup of your mother while you stand in the front room? It means that you know that something great is going to come while it is not there yet. Says Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, the same thing is true over here. What we do is, we say to God only one thing. God, we will give you a little indication of all the great things which still we hopefully are going to happen with us. We want to go through transformation. We want to reinform our lives. We want to restructure our lives in a better and a more spiritual form as you require. We can't just do this overnight.
So what we do is we just want to show you one thing. We have the right intentions. You can smell us coming in your direction. We're not there yet. The super's not there yet. But we want just to give a little indication to God that that is what we have in mind. There may be still a long road to go. Says Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, that's the meaning of the word Reach Nichoach Lashem. It has nothing to do with any physical kind of, let's say, perfume. It has nothing to do with anything physical altogether. It has to do with one act of man. Man says, I will make one step in the direction. I will show you a little bit that new kind of spiritual smell which will come from my particular spiritual condition. But I still have a long time to go, but it's the first indication. I think it was a brilliant way of looking to this issue, because it obviously explains very, very well what the Torah has got in mind and is totally in accordance to the general concept of what the Jewish tradition actually stands for. So we have here now a general, I would say, a general philosophy, basically, of what the Kashrut laws are all about, and we have a little bit of an insight into what the issues related to Korbanot, what the sacrifices are all about. The basic thing, and that is what we will stop for today, is that there is another fantastic method by which man opens himself up to the spiritual world, by which he is capable of growing, and that therefore we are very particular about eating kosher, and therefore, and that's perhaps the last thing and the most important thing to say about it, anybody claiming, as you so often hear, that the Kashrut laws are out of date by now, because in the olden days there were rules just to look after our bodies, that we would eat healthy stuff and things like that, which is an argument you hear 10,000 times over throughout the Jewish community, but now that the state has looked so carefully after the hygienic conditions of meat and of all sorts of other things, why to eat kosher is basically the kind of person who is missing the point and the boat altogether. As I said yesterday, the Kashrut laws are not there as a diet for the body, but they are basically a diet for the soul. And since the soul is not something which food just like that, as we find it in our shops, can look after, and the Torah gives us some insight in what food indeed has a certain influence and a certain effect on our souls, we therefore are very careful, because we know that as much as the body needs to grow, even more so the soul has to grow. And the basic thing is that they have to stay together for all the years that we are living in this world, and that's an art. The Kashrut laws are another way of somehow achieving this sort of thing. So let's not make the mistake, or whenever you hear people making these kind of mistakes, and I'm sure you're going to hear that when people say, well, you know, Kashrut laws don't need it anymore. Reformed Judaism has put it out a long time ago. Conservative Judaism has been playing around with it quite a lot. It is a very great pity, because it is perhaps one of the most beautiful traditions within the Jewish tradition, and it is no doubt something which we can still learn about so much as far as the future is concerned, that it is not old-fashioned. Perhaps it is a little bit too modern for man just to fully understand the indications and the, let's say, the implications of what food does to us, and in what way we can indeed do with food something which is of tremendous importance to the soul side of human beings. Okay, we shall discuss tomorrow something else.